Welcome to the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine. Meet him, greet him, treat him, and street him. Today's date is April 15th, 2015, and I am your skeptical host, Ken Milne. The title of today's podcast is Paramedics Got a Squeeze Box, Remote Ischemic Conditioning. And our guest skeptic is Clay Odell. Clay is a paramedic and the executive director of the Upper Valley Ambulance, a regional EMS system covering 9 communities in rural New Hampshire and Vermont. He's been involved in EMS for over 30 years in a variety of roles, including an urban paramedic, a flight paramedic, an emergency nurse, and chief of the state EMS office in New Hampshire. Clay is very interested in EBM for EMS and says he's trying really, really hard to learn, but continues to procrastinate about actually taking a statistics course again. Welcome to the SGM, Clay.
Thanks, Ken. I appreciate the invitation.
Well, I think it's great that we have an EMS person on the SGM to demonstrate that continuity of care.
I'm glad you're thinking along those lines.
Well, you know, we work as an emergency medicine team, and patients deserve that best care based on the best evidence from the moment they dial 911 till the point that they get in the emergency department, up in the inpatient unit or ICU, and until they're discharged from hospital care.
I couldn't agree more, Ken. I've learned a lot listening to the SGM over the past year or so, and I'm all about applying EBM to EMS protocols.
Well, we've covered a few EMS pre-hospital topics already on the SGM, including SGM number 54, Baby, It's Cold Outside, pre-hospital therapeutic hypothermia and out-of-hospital cardiac arrests.
Yep, and the bottom line there was scoop and run and no cooling required in the field.
Now, Clay, I don't want to hear any jokes about all Canadian patients arriving hypothermic because, you know, we just roll down the windows. We've got some spring weather here.
Well, we're only about 100 miles from the Canadian border here, so I won't make any jokes about your weather. I mean 160.934 kilometers.
Thank you for converting it for all the other listeners out there. Well, we've also did SGM number 59, Can I Get a Witness, about family members present during CPR.
Yep, that episode showed inviting family members to witness the resuscitation could decrease long-term stress. And actually, that's something that we here are doing in our service.
Oh, super. The other one I wanted to mention was SGM number 96, Machine Head Non-Invasive Positive Pressure Ventilation for Out-of-Hospital Respiratory Distress. This was done in New York City with the EM Swami and two of his awesome residents.
If the conclusion there was that NIPPV was a reasonable option for adult patients with out-of-hospital undifferentiated severe respiratory distress.
Well, I think, Clay, we've demonstrated that the SGM cares about pre-hospital care and the EMS service. So why don't you kickstart this episode with a case?
Absolutely. So your rural EMS unit is dispatched to a call for a 65-year-old man with chest pain. On scene, a 12-lead ECG is required in 6 minutes, revealing ST elevation in leads V3 through V6. The patient is given 324 milligrams of chewable aspirin, sublingual nitro, which reduces his chest pain, oxygen by nasal cannula at 2 liters per minute to maintain his SaO2 above 94%. The patient is removed from the second floor of his home by stair chair, placed on the stretcher, loaded in the ambulance, and transport is initiated to the closest PCI center. You call the hospital with a STEMI alert with a 30-minute ETA. En route, the patient is monitored. Serial 12 leads are done. Another nitro is given when chest discomfort returns, but otherwise you settle in for the ride. You recall reading an article in EMS Journal recently about remote ischemic conditioning, which is done by inflating a BP cuff on the patient's arm to 200 millimeters of mercury for 5 minutes, then release the pressure for 5 minutes, and repeat 3 more times. The article said this technique reduces myocardial damage from reperfusion injury after the PCI. It's not in your protocols, so you call online medical control to discuss it.
You know, listening to you talk about that case just reminds me all the amazing things you guys do in the field. You know, you get them all packaged up and they arrive, you know, in this nice bundle with this bow on top. But look at all the things you've already done in the pre-hospital setting. So that just reminded me of all the great things you guys are already doing before they even hit our door.
Yeah, well, particularly in a rural place like us, we have, so I guess you might call it the luxury of time, and then sometimes it's not so much of a luxury to have such a long transport. Might be a little bit different in an urban setting.
So let's talk about this remote ischemic conditioning. The phenomenon of ischemic preconditioning was reported almost 30 years ago in experiments done on dogs. These early studies looked at limiting infarct size. The technique involved a series of alternating periods of ischemia of the coronary artery with reperfusion sessions to render the myocardium more resistant to a subsequent ischemic event.
When a coronary vessel is occluded during an MI, myocardial cells distal to the occlusion suffer from ischemic injury. A reperfusion injury has been described once the flow has been restored via PCI that may increase the infarct size.
But unlike dog experiments, the remote ischemic conditioning, or RIC, involves placing a blood pressure cuff on an extremity, and it's typically on the arm, and you'll inflate it to 200 millimeters of mercury for 5 minutes and then release. And then this pattern is repeated 3 more times.
The exact mechanism behind remote ischemic conditioning is not known. There's thought to be a neuronal and humoral interaction mediating the protective effect.
You know, whenever they don't know the exact mechanism, it gets my skeptical radar up. But this RIC has been investigated in a number of large cardiac surgery trials and PCI trials, and they've reported benefit in improving cardiac markers and limiting infarct size. So that's enough background information, Clay. What's the specific clinical question we want to answer on today's episode of the SGEM?
So we want to know, does pre-hospital remote ischemic conditioning performed on STEMI patients decrease myocardial reperfusion injury and improve their long-term outcome?
And what's the reference for this?
So the reference is Sloth et al. Title is Improved Long-Term Clinical Outcomes in Patients with ST Elevation Myocardial Infarction Undergoing Remote Ischemic Conditioning as an Adjunct to Primary Percutaneous Coronary Intervention. And it was in the European Heart Journal in late 2014.
So let's go through the PICO. What was the population?
So the population was adults with symptoms less than 12 hours and STEMI on ECG.
So the exclusion criteria were diagnosis not confirmed upon hospital arrival, history of previous MI, previous coronary artery bypass grafting, and chest pain greater than 12 hours prior to admission. But Clay, I looked at the parent trial because they referred to that as the parent trial for this trial. And actually in the parent trial, they also excluded left bundle branch blocks, fibrinolytic therapy in the previous 30 days, left main stem stenosis, severe heart failure needing mechanical ventilation, and intra-aortic balloon pump. What was the intervention?
So the intervention was remote ischemic conditioning by inflating a blood pressure cuff on the patient's arm to 200 millimeters of mercury for 5 minutes, followed by release of pressure for 5 minutes, and performed a total of 4 times prior to PCI.
And their comparison?
Usual care.
And what was the outcome that they were looking for?
So the primary endpoint was MACE, or major adverse cardiac or cerebrovascular events, which is a composite of all-cause mortality, myocardial infarction, readmission for heart failure, or ischemic CVA or TIA. And the secondary endpoints they were looking for were the individual components of the MACE.
Now, Clay, I dug a little deeper and went to clinicaltrials.gov, and they did not mention any secondary outcomes for the MACE components. In fact, their secondary outcome that they did mention was left ventricular function and remodeling measured by echo, which they did not report in this study. The author's conclusions were, quote, remote ischemic conditioning before primary percutaneous coronary intervention seemed to improve long-term clinical outcomes in patients with ST elevated myocardial infarctions, end of quote. Let's go through the 11 questions for randomized clinical trials, Clay. Question number one, was the study population included or focused on those in the emergency department?
Not exactly. It focused on pre-hospital patients being transported by EMS to a PCI center.
Number two, the patients were adequately randomized?
Yes.
Did they conceal the randomization?
Yes.
Were they analyzed in the groups which they were randomized?
Yes.
The study patients, were they recruited consecutively?
They were.
Were they similar with regards to prognostic factors?
Well, patients in the intervention arm were more likely to have pre-existing hypertension than the control arm, but otherwise they were similar.
Were all participants unaware of their group allocation?
They weren't. Patients and clinicians were aware. The outcome assessors were not.
Question number eight. Were all groups treated equally except for the intervention?
Yes.
Did they have complete follow-up, i.e. more than 80% for both groups?
Yep, they had really good follow-up.
Did they look at all patient-important outcomes?
They did.
And the final question, question number 11, was the treatment effect large enough and precise enough to be clinically significant?
I'm not sure about that.
All right, so let's go through the results. They had 333 patients with suspected STEMIs randomized into the trial. Only 251 met trial criteria after randomization, and it was these patients that had a per-protocol analysis performed.
Yep. See, 82 were excluded. 34 were diagnoses of MI were not confirmed on arrival to the hospital. 4 were excluded due to previous CABG. 4 had chest pain greater than 12 hours, and 41 patients were excluded due to a previous MI.
And so their primary outcome of MACE, per protocol analysis, showed that 14% in the remote ischemic conditioning group and 26% in the control group, which gave a hazard ratio of 0.49.
Yep, and the secondary outcomes that they looked at, only the all-cause mortality was better with the RIC procedure. And they're looking at the all-cause mortality. They looked at a hazard ratio of 0.32.
And so the myocardial infarction, the readmission, and the CVA, TIA were not statistically different. So let's talk about these results. This study was a long-term follow-up to a study published in 2010 that looked at the same 251 patients who either received RIC, RIC, procedure, or the control group. And they looked at short-term outcome differences in the post-PCI myocardial damage as measured by a single photon emission CT.
Yeah, the group was pleased with their outcomes and went on to follow these patients through the Danish nationwide medical registries up to 5 years after their MI, looking to see if there were any differences in MACE.
And as you can imagine, there was a few issues or problems that I identified in the study. How many? 4? 6? No, Clay, there were 5. You know that if there was only 4, I was going to make one up. And if there was 6, I was going to combine 2 into 5, right?
Right. I've been listening long enough.
Yeah. So the first one was the per protocol versus the intention to treat analysis.
Yep. So some you and YouTube have taught me that both are tools to investigate the data, and they have strengths and weaknesses. Intention to treat analyses tend to be a better method because it's not biased by non-compliant patients, dropouts, and crossovers.
And the per protocol analysis excludes patients who deviated from the protocol and only include those who received the treatment. Doing a pre-protocol analysis can introduce something called attrition bias. This is a form of bias in which those groups of patients being compared no longer have similar characteristics. It tends to be a lower form of evidence, but better demonstrates the effect of the treatment itself when used in an optimal manner. These types of per-protocol analysis can be helpful in interpreting non-inferiority trials.
Yep, so they did both a per-protocol and an intention-to-treat analysis, but they highlighted only the per-protocol results. This makes us skeptical of the results because if you look at the ITT for the primary composite outcome of MACE, the hazard ratio is not nearly as robust, and it barely meets statistical significance.
The authors say they focused on the per-protocol analysis because the parent trial showed benefit in myocardial salvage index per protocol. For more information on ITT versus per-protocol analysis, there's a nice review by Sandeep Gupta, and I'll put a link up in the show notes. But let's move on to point number 2. Where was the benefit? Their secondary outcomes were the components of the MACE composite outcome. Only the all-cause mortality showed significant reduction in the hazard ratio.
Interestingly, when they broke this down into subgroup analysis for cardiac mortality versus non-cardiac mortality, the benefit was seen in the latter.
So in other words, the RIC intervention that was to decrease cardiac badness, i.e. death, did not seem to be superior to control. However, there were very few events in both groups, and that makes the results difficult to interpret.
And to make it even more complicated, the ITT analysis on all-cause mortality showed no statistical difference.
The third point we wanted to bring up is this study was not blinded. It was not a blinded trial for the providers or the participants. Only the outcome assessors were blinded to the treatment group. This could have introduced bias into the experiment. The EMS personnel may have treated the intervention group differently, even if on a subtle level.
Yeah, they could have attempted to blind the trial. For example, an automatic BP cuff that automatically inflated to either 200 millimeters of mercury for temporary ischemia, or it inflated to a value significantly less.
And then they could have even asked the paramedics and the patients post-intervention which, quote, arm of the trial they thought they were randomized, and this would have confirmed if the blinding was maintained. Number four is the time to complete this intervention.
Yeah, it occurs to me that this has the potential to slow things down in the field for a time-dependent emergency. The protocol calls for 5 minutes of inflation followed by 5 minutes of deflation, and this was done for four cycles, which takes a total of 40 minutes in total. And there was another paper that came out just last month where they did the entire RIC procedure after arrival at the hospital before or even possibly during the initiation of the PIC procedure.
Yeah, and in this trial, 16 of the 251 patients, so 6%, could not complete the four cycles of inflation-deflation because of the transport time wasn't sufficient. They continued the procedure in the hospital while the patients were getting ready for primary PCI.
So the question becomes, can you apply these results to your practice environment? It may depend on how long your transportation times are, and this could, if proven to be a benefit, play a greater role in rural remote areas like mine with longer transport times.
This brings me to point number five, external validity. This study was done in Denmark, where the EMS system could be substantially different than ours in North America. And Clay, you looked into this a bit.
Yeah, I am a bit familiar with the system there. And certainly in addition to the transport times that we're looking at, we consider what level of training that the Danish EMS system does. And typically, the Danish EMS system has a physician response on all ALS level calls. I'm not really sure in the setting of STEMI what a pre-hospital physician in Denmark would provide that a paramedic would provide in the U.S. or Canada, but that is a possible confounder.
All right, well, let's comment on the author's conclusions compared to the SGEM conclusions.
So the author's conclusion that RIC or RIC seemed to show improvement in long-term clinical outcomes in patients with STEMI gives them some wiggle room.
We would agree that there seem to be some benefit if you use their per protocol analysis, but there did not seem to be the benefit if you use the ITT analysis, considering the lack of blinding and the other limitations we've mentioned. So Clay, what's the bottom line?
So I would really like this technique to work, but I'd basically just have to say the technique has promise because it's cheap and it can be done by all levels of EMS provider.
However, there needs to be a large multi-centered trial using RIC showing improved patient-oriented outcomes before this becomes the routine treatment in the pre-hospital setting for STEMI patients.
And there is a trial going on right now. It's called CONDI 2. It's ongoing and it's anticipated to be concluded in 2016.
So how are you going to resolve the case that you presented at the start of this podcast?
So you discuss a recommendation that you made about the RIC procedure with your EMS medical director via cell phone. You and the doctor decide not to perform the procedure, but you agree to meet and review the literature to see if the procedure should be considered for inclusion in statewide protocols.
And so what's the clinical application of this research?
Unfortunately, none at this time.
So what would you tell the patient that you have in the back of the EMS vehicle?
Well, I just tell them that it appears, sir, as though you're having a heart attack and we're taking you to the hospital that can provide the care you need.
Excellent. Well, that sound reminds me that it's time to do the Keener contest. Last week's winner was Nathan Green from San Francisco. He knew that Claudius Amidon, famous for having done the first recorded appendectomy in 1735, was also famous for having a hernia named after him. Clay, what's the Keener contest this week?
What was the first study that was published on preconditioning ischemia to protect ischemic myocardium?
Well, if you know the answer, then send me an email to thesgem@gmail.com with Keener in the subject line. The first person to correctly answer the question will receive a cool skeptical prize. Now, I wanted to mention a couple of conferences. I'll be attending the CAPE conference in Edmonton, May 30th to June 3rd, and then I'll be heading to the Windy City itself, Chicago for the SMAC conference, June 23rd to 26th. I hope to see some of my FOMED friends. Thank you, Clay, for suggesting a show on remote ischemic conditioning.
Well, Ken, thank you for your reply when I asked for your help figuring out whether the RIC procedure could be considered evidence-based for EMS practice yet.
Well, you know what? It's always great to work with such talented paramedics, nurses, PAs, NPs, EM pharmacists, and the whole team that provides emergency care.
Yeah, I really like that you bring other disciplines into your podcast. I hope more EMS providers take advantage of your work.
Well, will you come back on the SGEM and help me put a skeptical eye when the CANDY 2 trial is released?
Absolutely.
Until then, will you give the SGEM tagline? But you need to do it with a thick New England accent.
Well, I'll try and channel my grandfather. Remember to be skeptical of anything you learn, even if you heard it on the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine.
Talk to everyone next week.
Mama's got a squeeze box, hey!